Hello, hello, hello. How is everybody doing? Feliz 4 de Julio. Just kidding. I don't know. Like, the only thing I like about 4 de Julio, I'm just gonna keep calling it 4 de Julio. The only thing that I really like about 4 de Julio is fireworks, but, you know, they keep you up all night, so it's not that exciting. But I guess I'm in a new city, so I gotta enjoy. I don't engage with celebrations of the nations like that, ni en México ni aquí. So if you're celebrating, God bless. I'm not. I'm just sitting in my home. I am re-listening to this episode, to this interview that you're about to listen. I am very excited to bring this interview because I think it's very fitting. Here we are. Again, it's 4 de Julio, and we're celebrating certain myths about not only about the place where we live, where the place that we grew up, but also part of our identity, because as children of this nation, we are raised to believe that our identity has to be rooted on nationhood, on la felicidad de ser americano, you know, even though everybody calls themselves here Americans, even though that's the whole continent. U.S. citizens will be something more specific, but how can we go outside and celebrate 4 de Julio when there's a lot of shit happening? There's a lot of shit happening throughout the whole entire country. ICE raids everywhere. You have a mess in the border that I'm not going to get into because I am not going to engage on all the sentimentality. You know what's happening. You know what's going on. You know the urgency to help and try to make a change. And we can all do our part, but at the end of the day, it's up to those people in La Casa Blanca. So no, I am not going to celebrate today. Instead, I am going to bring you, this interview with an amazing woman that I met here in Chicago. Her name is Ana Lu Lopez. She's a librarian at the Newberry, and you'll hear all of the details. But I wanted to tell you a little bit more about what we talk about because, you know, I get excited and then I forget to put things in context. So one of the reasons why I met Ana Lu, which you will hear in the podcast, is because I wanted to see El Mapa de Cortés. What is El Mapa de Cortés? So when Hernán Cortés, after defeating the Aztecs from 1519 to 1521, he wrote letters, in a way, explaining what happened in Tenochtitlan, because at that time, Mexico City was Tenochtitlan. It was Aztec land. So what happened was that he wrote these letters explaining how wonderful Tenochtitlan was, that it was a city that no European city could no se podía comparar, because it was just beautiful, it was clean, and et cetera, et cetera. And in fact, when you look, I'm getting ahead of myself, but anyway, so he also draw this map. And as I mentioned in the episode, the history of the world starting from 1492 is to appease white anxieties. What does that mean? How do you portray Americans? And by Americans, I mean people from the continent. How do you show the different customs, the different belief systems, the different religions? It's through a system of analogies. It's through a system of making people feel comfortable with what happens right here. So new fruits had to be explained, new animals had to be explained, new peoples had to be explained, and new customs and new cities had to be explained. And of course, because the principal interest was to own things, was to conquest, the Europeans spent 300 years in a way manipulating who we are. Who we are, or who we were, or who the American peoples were in this continent. And one of the first examples of that is this map that we talk about here in this episode, where you look at it and it looks nothing. It looks nothing like the actual city of Tenochtitlan. There's a couple of things. I mean, there's a link in our website of how the map looks. And actually, this is a good opportunity to push you to go to the website, because we talk about certain things. We talk about maps. We talk about certain visuals that it will be cool for you to sit down, to listen, and to click on the show notes, on the links, and you can see what we're talking about. So you look at this map, and it's a bird's eye view of the island of Tenochtitlan, which is in the middle of Lake Texcoco. And now again, the whole entire thing has been filled, and now it's Mexico City, one of the reasons why there's so many earthquakes. But anyway, and again, it looks like Venice. It looks like a medieval city. But that was a way for Hernán Cortés to try to explain what he saw here. And it's a problem, because instead of trying to reveal the truths about the ways of that the Aztecs understood the world, the ways of the Nahuatl people, the people in the Valley of Mexico understood the world in a completely different way than the Europeans. Instead, you have these conquistadores that just want to make the king and the queen happy so they can get a piece of land. So also I talk about an article, and you know, I'll give you the details later, but in this article, this guy talks about how after 1492, the subjectivity, the way that Europeans see themselves, is not so much the I think, therefore I am, you know, I believe in religion, therefore I am, which was the medieval understanding, the European of the medieval European understanding of the world. Instead, is I conquer, therefore I am, I genocide, therefore I am. So in a way, now we are in 2019, we are commemorating 500 years of the beginning of that understanding of really the solidification of white supremacy, because in a way the Spanish had a lot to do with that. So as you are sitting down enjoying your burger and your French fries people, as you're sitting down and enjoying your colonial taco, think about these things. Think about how the identities of who we are in this country began 500 years ago. And even though we celebrate freedom, what the fuck does that mean? So think about that. Enjoy this amazing, amazing, amazing interview. I'm very proud of everything that Ana Lu is doing in the Newberry Library. Think about that. Listen, and then stay tuned, because at the end I'm going to give you a music recommendation just to wash off all this fucked up nationality that is happening around us. And hopefully you'll enjoy some nice talk and some music. So, yes, enjoy.
Hey, everybody.
So, I'm full. I had amazing food. And I'm in the presence on some, like, a badass person that I met a couple of months ago, actually. And I want to tell you all about it. I am here with my friend, Ana Lu. Tell me your last name, because I forgot to ask you.
Ana Lu Lopez.
Okay, Ana Lu Lopez. Before we get into what we're going to get into, because we're going to get into it, I want you to tell our audience a little bit of what you do, and then we'll talk about the food that we just ate, because it was off the hook, everybody.
Yeah, so I do a lot of things. The way we met was at the Newberry Library. So that's my day job, I would say. I'm a reference librarian at the Newberry Library of Chicago, which is a special collections, non-circulating library focused on the humanities. Then on side from that, I do a lot of community work. I'm from La Villita, a little village here in Chicago. I've been born and raised here, still live in the community. I do community work, and I also work on like indigenous language revitalization efforts, specifically Nahuatl within the community. I'm a photographer. I garden.
She does everything, you all. So I met Ana Lu because I wanted to do some research in the Newberry Library. I just find out through her that one sermon that I worked for my dissertation, they had the original copyright there, the one from 1681. And we're not going to get into it because then it's going to get boring. But so I saw this girl with all this like Aztec jewelry, beautiful wood earrings that said, this is not your land, or this is Indian land. And I was like, okay, I see her. She needs to be in the podcast. And then I was like, will you be in my podcast? And she was so nonchalant. She's like, sure, yeah, I'll do it. And I'm like, yeah, I have a podcast called Latinos Who Lunch. And then?
Then I said, oh my God, shut up. I didn't realize I had seen him a couple of times, and then finally when I connected the dots, I fangirled basically. So
it was awesome, because after that she's like, I'm gonna show you everything. So we went behind backstage to the Newberry, and we saw some amazing things. But before we get into that and some of the documents that I show you, because I want to talk about el mapa de Cortés that you show me, I invited her for dinner, and I made her my mom's world famous, after this podcast, she calls them tacos callejeros. And tacos callejeros are just like como de bistec, pero en Juárez no los comemos con pepino, con pico de gallo, and she makes them with, magic, like Nor Suiza, sal, pimienta, y tocino. Dude, my tacos are the shit. You can ask anybody. And then Ana Lu reciprocated and invited my husband and I here to her house. And was it you or your husband that made dinner?
My husband made dinner. He insisted that he...
What do we eat?
So he made enchiladas verdes with the secret ingredient. We use queso chihuahua on it. Oh. So I use the same thing for my lasagna, queso chihuahua. So it's like Mexican lasagna. and then just un arroz con corn in it. So, yeah.
I inhaled those enchiladas. They were so, so good. Like, they tasted like, I don't know, like, it brought me back to something. I couldn't say what, but I was like, oh, I've tasted that flavor before.
No, he throws down when he cooks. He loves cooking. We both cook. But he, if given the choice, he prefers to do it. And he's happy to do it, which is nice for me. When I'm like, okay, go ahead, babe.
You're like, all right, you do what you do. So this house is full of books. So I have never met and there's a lot of Latinx librarians out there. Like, I'm about to do the keynote speech for Reforma, and like a branch of the American Librarians Association. So there's a lot of us out there, but I've never met one before, especially in art, working with such incredibly important archives. So tell me a little bit of how you got into books. How do you get into your work as a librarian, and what does it mean to you?
I'd say books were part of my life growing up. My aunts took us to the library all the time. So when I remember at the age as young as 5 or 6, I was just loved books. I just loved being able to read all these different stories, and you know, the whole cliche, you're taken into another world, right? It's like amazing. And I became a sponge at a young age. So I remember prior to getting into this work, I wanted to be a writer. So anyone asked me, what do you want to do when you grow up? Oh, I want to write novels and stuff like that. So actually, as an undergrad, I was a English major, and then I switched over really drastically, still kind of in the arts, but I went into like photography. I still had like Latino studies as a minor.
And this was where?
At Columbia College here in Chicago. Yeah. So I went to Harold Washington first, and then I transferred over to Columbia College, saved a ton of money doing that. Went to a community college, transferred over to a 4-year. And then I just kind of got into like archives and stuff like that. So as an undergrad, a position opened up on one of like the student sites for jobs, and it was at the Newberry. This was like in 2004, and they were looking for someone to help photograph and digitize the what they called the Edward E. Ayer art collection. And I wasn't familiar with the library a lot. The only time I'd heard about it was in an undergraduate like histories of Hispanics and something, one of those long history classes titles. And the professor told us, hey, do you know the Popol Vuh and the Cortez map is here in Chicago? And a group of us went over. We couldn't believe that you can actually see these materials. So that's when I heard about the Newberry, and then this job posted, and I got it So that was my first introduction to this collection. After that, it was grant funded, so I was only really there for maybe 7 months or so. Then I worked in different institutions like the Museum of Contemporary Art, the Mexican Fine Art Museums, now known as the National Museum of Mexican Art. I worked at other libraries. And anytime anyone asked me, where do you want to work? I said the Newbery. One day I'll work there. That was like my dream job. I wanted to work there. Everyone knew that. Like once I knew about the position or the artwork or the collection, I said, I'm going to go back there and work one day. 13 years later, I got that wish. about 2 years ago, I've been in this position for about 2 years. So working not only with the what we call the Edward E. Ayer art, like collection, but more broadly, the American Indian Indigenous Studies material.
Let me tell you guys, like it's amazing and it's very inspiring to see what you do, because not only you are a librarian, not only are you there with the books and understand the content, but you're reaching out to the community, and that's super important for me. So to go back to our meeting, our first day, I remember, for example, I've heard of El Mapa de Cortés, right? And for those of you who may not be familiar with it, El Mapa de Cortés is the first map drawn by a European of Tenochtitlan. And this map was created in 1521, and it was 1524, right? And it was published as part of the letters of Hernán Cortés. And if you don't know Hernán Cortés, Google the loca, because I don't want to get into it because I'm going to be very fucking upset. Anyway, so he draws this map that looks like Venice, but it was the first introduction to Europe to what Tenochtitlan looked like. And that's super important. That's super important. So what is it, for example? And I noticed that you extend this map to the community when people come from other parts of Mexico, for example. Like I see pictures in your Instagram where you have that. So tell me about the importance of you to show this type of documents to like people in the community, not just like scholars, for example.
Yeah, I think one of the main things that I was really thought was really important in this position when I started was connecting the community within the archives, because a lot of the documents are our histories, right? So a lot of it has to do with our history and histories that maybe we weren't even taught ourselves. I can speak from experience not being taught a lot of this in, you know, like in grammar school or high school, not until I was an undergrad. And for me, I think it's really important that not only scholars have access to this, but also our community members have access to it. So anytime I know someone's on site and I can engage with them and show them something, especially let's say if there's only Spanish speakers as well, like I'm the only, well, maybe a couple of people speak Spanish, but that the staff member that's bilingual, soon to be trilingual, I think it's really important because once we're there and I'm showing them, even the youth, because I have a special warm spot for youth and having access to this, because I think back to that age and not having access to my history. And I've had high school students that come in and I'll ask them questions, and you know, sometimes they'll be intimidated and they'll say like, oh, I don't know, I'm not a scholar. And I try to reverse that, right, and tell them, no, you are a scholar. You too can be an authority, not just like, you don't have to just have a PhD to come in here and, you know, and really analyze stuff and interact with the material, right? So kind of breaking down those barriers within institutions like this, because when you think about it, the institutions weren't really made with us in mind, right? Later, you know, I feel I can like go on about this, where I'm just like, oh, I start getting angry, because then I'm just like, you know, a lot of these colonial institutions, you know, who would have thought now, right, a person of color, a woman that's working in this collection, that can engage the communities that a lot of these stories come from and a lot of these documents are part of, right? So it really is like an honor for me, and I take it very like seriously, like to engage the community whenever they're around and they inquire to come into the Newbery.
I think that's very important, because we do have those, I want to say, not categories, but those, the stratification of knowledge. And that made me think of an article, and I think I talked about this article in the podcast before. It's by Ramon Grossfugel. It's called The Structure of Knowledge in Westernized Universities, Epistemic Racism, Sexism, and the Four Genocide Epistemicides of the Long 16th Century. And in that article, they talked about how we have everything we know. our idea of knowledge as it is being constructed in the Western Hemisphere is based on five countries and white straight men from these five countries. Everything that we know. So when we start thinking about it, we realize the epistemicide that has occurred around the world. And by that, I mean the destruction of other forms of understanding the world.
And I think that's really connected. And another thing that I'm really passionate about is linguistics. So I'm really passionate about indigenous languages. And that goes right into like other ways of understanding the world, right, within language. So, for instance, I've been studying Nahuatl for about 10 years with a dictionary. I can read it. But conversationally is where about a year ago I met someone that was wonderful and really patient with me to teach me, because I told them that's where I feel that another way of thinking and approaching the world can be found within our languages, with our indigenous languages. And that's where I really dedicated myself to like learning it, because there are different ways like for us to think within our language, our indigenous languages, versus like just English and Spanish.
Right. And that applies to everything, right? That applies to everything. So I think it is important to offer a window through the work that you do, that we can get at least a peek of other ways of understanding the world, of seeing different things. And to me, super important to actually have a Latina show me these collections, because just like in the museum, many times these institutions that you mentioned were not made for us, and we are always outside of them. And even though these institutions benefit from our forms of understanding the world, we are not reflected in those spaces. So from the moment you got my card, my library card, to the moment that you show me this document that potentially is very oppressive, but it's also important, right? This the letters of Hernán Cortés, I really felt privileged. I really felt privileged that it was, I've had a lot of experiences in archives in Mexico, and that's completely different, right? But it was the first time in the United States that I had a Latina, you know, like a Latinx person show me and really understand. And everything I talk to you about, you're like, yep, we have this, we have that, we have that. Girl, you're saving me hours of research. You don't even know.
Yeah, even I think just right now, too, before we started, we were nerding out on like stuff. I'm like, oh, we have this. You need to look into this. This is going to help with your research.
Yeah, I am. I'm already like thinking of five papers. I'm like, oh, I can't wait. I'm so blessed with Analu in Chicago. So I don't know how long I'm going to be here in the city, but be sure that I'm going to be using your expertise a lot. So let's talk about the map of Cortés. Just very quickly, because I know it's a long history, how did it get to the Newberry? And what does it mean for you to show it to other communities? Because this is, again, potentially an enraging document. So why is it important for you to show it to other people?
Yeah, so I'll start with like how it got to the Newberry. So it was part of, it came in as part of the donation of Edward Ayer. So Edward Ayer was a trustee of the Newberry. He was also the first president of the field. Philanthropist, collector, lover of indigenous materials, and he created this vast collection that I have the privilege of working with now. So it came part of the original donation in 1911. There's only one of two in the world, and we have one of them. So one of two that are in color. So I think total of the collection of that map, there's 12, and the other, like, 10 are in black and white. So we do have one of the original printed in Nuremberg in 1524 in color, which is amazing still to think about. Wow, I'm like basically in the presence of a map that would have first been created and with the idea to show, right, these lands, these beautiful lands, with the intention of saying, you know, look at this beautiful land that we conquered, basically, right? So it's also, like you said, enraging too, because if we know the history, this was printed in 1524. This happened, what we call the conquest, right, when 1521 in Mexico. So when you think about it, it's also very upsetting, right? Because you wouldn't have seen it, these beautiful lands, 1524, that's what, 3 years later, so it wouldn't have really existed the way it was intended in the map, right?
And that's kind of how I show it in class, because one of the things that we learn in class is that the history of colonization and the history of the world, really, because it's still happening right now, it really is appeasing white anxieties. So imagine, if the United States discovers another planet, we're all going to freak out that there's another form of life somewhere else, right? So how does the government of the United States let us know that what's over there is safe or it's unsafe? It's unsafe enough that we need to colonize. It's safe enough for us to visit, for example. And that's exactly what happens with this. So the map looks like Venice, even though it's supposed to be Tenochtitlan. And it's very interesting to see it in that regard, because from that moment on, it is a way to create these categories where, like, the Spanish are on the tops and everybody are on the bottom. And how do you do that? It's through visual culture. So this is probably one of the first pieces that is going to create those distinctions between what this guy in this article, Ramon Grosfogel, mentions as the imperial being as opposed to everybody else, quote unquote, the other.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Exactly. And I think we talked about this before, like Barbara Mundi, how she wrote a whole article dedicated to this map and dissecting it. And I find it interesting how she like describes it. It was meant to be seen like it looks almost like a jewel, this beautiful jewel, right? For that they found, and it's safe for us to come and live here, and it's beautiful, right? Not keeping in mind the indigenous populations, however, right, that were there, and the stuff that was happening, the very ugly stuff that was happening for this. So
there's a codex that was created under Bernardino de Sahagún, who was a Franciscan. It's a long story, but this codex tells us a lot about the life in Tenochtitlan. But there's a section of the codex, and this is something that I learned from Magaloni, who's like this amazing scholar working in the Los Angeles County Museum. And she talks about how part of the codex is in black and white because the people that were creating the pigments, right, yeah. They were dying.
Yeah, you had people that were, I mean, you had artists, right, that were basically the artists of creating these, like, the codices, right? So they were skilled at writing, and then you had people that were skilled at interpreting, you had people that were knowledge keepers, right? Who are the first ones that they wanted to get rid of, right? Knowledge keepers. So we kind of have a joke, like, it's a really bad joke, but I would be a knowledge keeper, so I'd probably be the first to go, right? Because I'm the one that's keeping all this knowledge to disseminate and share with people, right? So that was kind of like one of the ugly things too, right, of colonization that happened and still happens, right? Wanting to get rid of these sorts of things, these knowledges, for conversion purposes, right? So Sahagún, I'm a fan of that, like the encyclopedic, is that the one you're talking about? The encyclopedic, Codex Florentino. Yeah, no, towards the 12th, I think there are 12 volumes, and towards the end you start seeing the absence of color because a lot of these painters, these artists were no longer, they weren't around and they were passing on that tradition of painting and stuff.
Yeah, because they were dying of diseases and smallpox. Yeah, and all kinds of, and okay, so this brings me to the next topic, and this is something that, the Instagram generation loves like trendy words and trendy ideas. So now like everybody wants to decolonize hasta la cola, like everything, right? And I find it problematic to think about it in that world, not because I idealize the colonial world, but because denying the colonial pasts of our ancestors is denying 500 years of pain. 500 years of pain and labor and a lot of things that happen against our will. Denying the colonial period is denying ourselves in many, many different ways. It's almost like saying by decolonizing the world, we will not be here, right? So I think a severe approach of decolonizing the world will be like getting rid of this type of documents. Right. But your work and what you do shows us that, no, that's not the case.
No, and I tell some students sometimes that come through, like they're always curious about the language, right? That I've been learning and why, and I tell them through research, through history, through family stories too. I know my family would have spoken indigenous languages, and I've been able to pinpoint two of them. So I've learning one of them. The other one's very difficult. How do we start learning these languages, right? They asked me. So I said, well, I picked up, you know, the dictionary that I found about like in 2003, and I found one that was at a library, then I bought it. Then I, you know, got introduced to this collection, and we have a lot of those colonial books. The dictionaries are created by Franciscans, by Dominicans, by Augustinians. We have all the first editions, right? So sometimes you go to those if you find copies online and you study the words without having a mentor around, right? So I tell them, I love the transformative nature of these documents, right? Because they were intended to convert, but then you see where we flip them and we start reclaiming them and it starts helping us learn the language again, right? And I'm like, I wonder if they had thought that we would have been doing that like 500, 400 years ago, that all of a sudden these become transformative in nature versus like work for conversion purposes. So I always tell students that.
Yeah, and that's super important. So that's what I will call, or that I learned that from my friend Annette Rodriguez, shout out, Annette, an anti-colonial gesture. That there's certain things that we cannot deny in our colonial past, but there's certain gestures that we can do to get rid of a lot of the oppressive nature of the colonial past. So I find it fascinating that your mere presence in this institution, our mere presence in institutions like big museums, are anti-colonial gestures, because just our faces right there are going to reprogram the way that we see these collections for a lot of people. So seeing a brown face giving a tour of Roman art, for example, it's already a political statement. So to me, your mere presence in the collection, such an authoritative face in the collection, really is an anti-colonial gesture as opposed to like a decolonial presence.
Right. Well, thank you.
Like, you're welcome.
To say to that, I'm like, oh yeah, you know.
No, and
no, I do. I agree with that, because like I'm seeing also like a lot of the work that's being done at the Field Museum and a lot of the people that I work with too within like the Native American community here, and the stuff that's happening there, I'm not sure if I'll try to summarize, but they're doing a revamping of the Native American Hall, and hasn't been done in 60-70 years, right? So Deborah Yepa Papan, hello if you hear this. I love the work she's doing too, because she's also engaging communities that are coming through, like Native American communities, that also with this idea that even their presence there at a colonial institution like that is extremely important, and one that I think should be around for a while, because I know from what I hear it's temporary, but I think it's really important that they stay there, right? Because I think it'd be a disservice to the type of work that's happening right now, that we're engaging these communities, and it's something that needs to continue.
Yeah, because we see exhibitions, and there was like a big case right now, which we're not going to get into, in the Art Institute here in Chicago of a Mimbres show, and they were not really, there was, I don't know the details, and I'm not going to get into it. You want to talk a little bit about that? Let's get into it. Okay.
Yeah. So I know a lot of the backstory on that and people that were working on that. Basically, the show was going to go up at the Art Institute, and what happened was they didn't consult any community members until after the fact these decisions have been made, right?
And by community, we mean like the indigenous community. Indigenous
communities, the Native American community, the Pueblo community, people that really should have a voice in how this is going to be represented and if it should be represented or not, right? So the backstory with the collection was a lot of them were grave robbed, right? So already with that, that's already a red flag, and that stuff that, you know, that should have been consultation should have happened way before like these decisions had been made, and it had not, right? So it seemed like they wanted to almost get the approval after the fact, which isn't the way things should work when you're working with community members. It should start right at the beginning.
And this is the first show that they pulled the plug. I think this is the first show in the Art Institute history where they pulled the plug. So, you know, silver linings. Things are changing, but this is why I push kids in my classrooms to continue to school, to stay in school. And I know the system is increasingly pushing us out of universities. But I push them to stay in school, even though they're going to have debt, you know. I push listeners to stay in school because it is because of that. It is because when we have people of power like yourself, for example, people of power in museums where we raise our voice, or just our mere presence, where we actually have change. And this show, the fact that you have people raising their voice, is going to change the way that this institute does exhibitions from now on.
Yes, and I've met the new curator. I think the curator for that show left, and they had a new curator there. And I met him, and he's really lovely. He's working with the community. He's showing his face around so we know, you know, who he is and stuff like that. And I do think stuff like this, slowly but surely, we're seeing changes, and I hope it continues, because now everyone, we're looking at all institutions and how they're going to be acting from now on, right? So if... I think now we're not afraid to really speak up and say, like, no, that's wrong. You shouldn't be doing that, right? And even in the work at the library, like, if I need to consult with someone on something, many times I do, especially because of the nature of the material. It's indigenous material. There's some stuff that's culturally sensitive. We have protocols for that, how we handle stuff that we're not going to show, whether it's on the website, in galleries, or even or in person. Yeah, so we have those protocols set, you know, out of respect too for the community and what should and shouldn't be shown.
And that's how it should be. And basically, this is something we talk about in the podcast a lot. Like, when we talk about diversity, I hate that word now because because diversity to the people that can actually make diversity happen in these spaces doesn't mean the same thing that it means to us. So I always talk about the D word, right? And it's like what's happening, for example, with Netflix, what's happening with a lot of these movies. We're seeing brown faces and what we think are brown stories, but at the bottom of it, all the producers are still these white people that are making these decisions that are controlling the way they are being portrayed. That's why we have cholos, and there's nothing wrong with that, right? Like, I want to see some good cholo story, right? But, like, we have the same stereotypes over and over again, and nothing's changing, and that's what's been happening in the museum world for a long time. That's why you have, when it came to Mexican art, it was always surrealist and muralist, just a shed that white people felt comfortable with. Just like the way that Europeans look at the map of Cortez and felt comfortable because it looked like Venice, it's still happening in television. It's still happening in movies, and it's still happening in libraries and in the museum world. But anyway, so I wanted to ask you one more thing. I know you're working with all these Nahuatl documents. You showed my husband and I this beautiful poem, this beautiful story, and you said that you worked really hard translating it. You finally found somebody to help you translate, and you want to push to take this very important 16th, 17th, 18th century Nahuatl documents outside of the library. So tell me a little bit more of that, because I feel like you're going to continue doing this work, and it's super important.
Yeah, and I got really excited when you're like, yay, we're going to talk about this. So what I showed you guys was a 16th to 17th century play that was written by an anonymous person. We're not sure who wrote it, but it's a new acquisition we got to the library, and it's a Nahuatl play, right? So it's a comedic play, and I got really excited when we purchased it too for the collection, because usually when you see these plays from the 16th, 17th, 18th century, they're usually religious in nature, and what I really liked about this one was that it's a good old-fashioned just comedy, right? So it's meant for you, and even says in the beginning in Nahuatl, it says it's a comedic play to make you laugh a lot, right? So
can you, I mean, I don't want to put you in the spot, but like, do you remember a little bit of the story? Because you were telling us, and it was so beautiful.
I thought you were going to tell me to say it in Nahuatl. I was like, oh my God, I'm not ready yet.
No, but tell us about the story, because it was a beautiful story.
Yeah, so the story is basically between a grandmother and her grandson, and the grandmother had brought home honey, and she brought it in like this gourd, and she was really excited. She's like, you know, really looking forward to eating it. And the scene starts where she walks in holding a gourd, and she's hunched back over, and the grandson's there in the room, and he's asking her, oh, what do you have there? You know, she goes, ilamaton, right? It's like elderly woman. I'm not what word for elderly woman. And she's like, oh, nothing. This is poison for the dogs. Don't eat it. Don't touch it. Right. So she walks away. And then the grandson comes in, and he sticks his finger in the gourd to grab some, and he eats it. And then he goes really dramatically. He's acting like he's dying and all this stuff's happening to him. And oh my God, I should have listened to my grandmother. But he's all lying, right? It's just being overly dramatic. And
me.
Yeah. The grandmother comes back and she's like, oh my God, where's all my honey, right? And the grandson's like, oh, the dogs ate it. I saw them. And he's like, don't lie. I know you ate my honey, blah, blah, blah. And she starts calling him like this imbecile glutton and I don't know what. And then like, it's like, it's really just a cute little story. Cause then like it ends, it's really simple, short. It's about three pages, really small pages, about, I don't know, 400 words. So it's really small. Short, and it ends where the grandmother's like chasing the nephew off stage, yelling to him, you glutton, I wanted the honey and now it's gone and blah, blah, blah. So my idea with it is, it took me forever to transcribe. So the first step was transcribing. So if anyone's ever seen 16th to 18th century script, some of them are more legible than others. This one was one of the I could not read this. It was illegible. And it was, it took me almost a year to do just one page by myself. And I don't even know if I got all the transcriptions correct. So I did end up finding two. One is my friend, native speakers of Nahuatl. And then another person based out of Albany that I just recently contacted, like, I think it was 2 weeks ago. And he transcribed it within like 3 days. So his paleography, like his paleography, like way of being able to read these documents is super advanced, and I was impressed. So I'm working with them, with my friend. His name is Victorino Torres Nava. He is also teaches his language in LA, at Anahuacalmecac, which is an indigenous school out there.
Shout out.
And I was just basically proposed to him if he'd want to do an article about the history of like Nahuatl theater and stuff like that, and kind of like start activating these plays within the collection. So what I mean by that is we start putting on a show using these plays, right? But I also wanted to use this one as like the first one where we can also not do it in Nahuatl in the Newbery, but also in the community. And we start putting on little plays and stuff like that in the community where community members can come. Because I mean, sometimes I'm like, it'd be great to do something at the Newbery, but I also understand as like a person that's from the community, sometimes getting out over to downtown, sometimes getting to the Gold Coast, you know, sometimes it's just also better to just work in the community and do it that way.
And that, ladies and gentlemen, is an anti-colonial gesture, taking an epistemology outside of potentially an oppressive institution. And I know that Newbery is an amazing institution, but the beginnings of libraries, for example, have this oppressive history, taking that outside and making it back, putting it back to the world, putting it back to the community and involving everybody. We're like the people in power are not the people at the center of that knowledge anymore. Once you take it out of the Newbery, it's not yours anymore. And I know it took you like years. And you know that. And you absolutely understand. And that's the beauty of it. And that's why I think what you do is so essential and so important, because a lot of people want to be our saviors, want to give us voices. Where it's like, it's not about giving voices to the voiceless. Everybody has a fucking voice, right? We all have ways of understanding the world and we all have our histories. But an anti-colonial gesture will allow us to expand that and to take the life that it's supposed to have taken 300-400 years ago.
Yeah, and when I think about the history of the theater too, it also was like partially used as like a tool to convert too, right, early on. And I'm like, oh, it'd be great, right? We're going to do it in the hood. We're going to get community members involved. You know, we're going to get people that are like native speakers too. And then people in this other thing that I'm doing, right, a class that they're learning Nahuatl, we can get them involved too, where you start practicing the language and feeling more comfortable learning one of your languages and stuff like that. So I get really excited, and I'm hoping this could happen next year. I've just proposed it. The Newbery likes it. The people that I talk to, they're like, oh, that'd be great. So it's in the very beginning stages at this point. So
whatever you need, just use us. But is this something that you just started? Have you been doing it for a while? And do you want to do more things like that?
I'd say the work that I've done in the community is I've been doing it for a while, because I'd probably started like in 2003 really being involved, right? I started different art groups, different, like we put on exhibits in the community. So I've been doing that since 2003, and this is just like a different approach, right? Using special collections library, right? Using documents like that, that's definitely new. I've never done that, but I get excited about being able to activate these collections and use them like that.
You get people pissed when they go to the collection. I remember
I send a picture to my friend in Puebla. I'm like, oh my God, I just saw this. And he's like, oh, great. I'm like, it's here in Chicago. It's the original one. He's like, what? He's like, steal it and bring it over here. And I was like, oh, I wish I could do that.
We do always have these conversations do come up about like, well, what's it doing here? Why is it here? Right. Like for the, for instance, the Popol Vuh that we talked about.
For those of you who don't know, Popol Vuh, it's the one that they have in the Newberries from the 17th century, right? Or 18th century. 18th century, and it's the origin of the world by the Mayans.
Yes, and it also came in as part of that original donation by Edward Ayer in 1911. So it's probably one of the most visited manuscripts at the Newberry within that collection. Just the last 2 weeks, it's probably already been pulled like 6 times or so.
So. Mis Suegros is one of them.
Yeah, yes, yes. And it has a really interesting long story on how it arrived here. But one of the questions that come up in like the groups too is, why is it here? Has anyone ever asked for it to be returned, repatriated, right? So we've never gotten a formal repatriation request. However, the Consulado de Guatemala has visited, even the Consulado de Guatemala here, the offices, they visit almost every year to see it. And they usually are very thankful. I feel like we're like neutral ground where we have it publicly available and accessible so anyone can come and see it. We don't limit it, right? So if it was like in private hands, let's say, no one would probably be able to see this. So we've never gotten a formal request, but there are people sometimes questioning, well, why is it here, right? Why is it here? And then I tell them the story of how I got here and stuff like that. It's always like a nice conversation. Not too many people getting really upset. I think once we start talking about how it happened, they start understanding it a little bit more. They've asked, I know one of the questions is like, well, if you got a formal request, would you? And I usually say it's above me, but it probably would. I would like to think, right? If it was, you know, we would do the right thing by them, by whoever requests it.
Because it's already digitized, no?
Yeah, it's digitized. So we make it available on the World Digital Library. So it's on there. And then anytime anyone wants a copy, I send them like the copy I have, the digital copy, which is accessible online as well, anyway, to download. We have facsimiles. I think they made a limited number of the facsimiles, but there's talk about hopefully maybe making more copies. We give those copies usually to like El Consulado de Guatemala here in Guatemala, and I think like the actual indigenous community, like Chichicastenango. So we do also have people that come from the community that do a ceremony every 5 years on the book. Yeah, so they do a ceremony basically like for themselves on the book, and then they also kind of like extend the thanks to the library and the people that are protecting it. And
so yeah, ven raza, like I know we all get mad, I know we get upset, and we all want to decolonize this and that, but sometimes, and this is what I tell my students, there's the myth of the museum, there's the myth of the artist, and we're talking here about the myth of the library. But at the end of the day, we're in a world where we need those institutions. And I think the real problem is not the existence of those institutions, because that's not going to go away anytime soon. The real problem is, how do we make these colonial, anti-colonial gestures and continue like the spread of this knowledge and the idea that you have institutions that put money to push it out in the community, to give access to scholars, but also digitalizing. That's where the real concern is, because there's a lot of institutions still that won't let you see. And I mean, and I'm going to sound bad, but like I've gone to so many archives in Mexico where like solo el padrecito de la iglesia, güey, puede ver like he, they can only, the only ones that have access to that knowledge. And it's understandable. Some of that knowledge should remain within the communities, right? But when it's not, and when it's in stages like the Newberry, because this is a world-renowned libreria, like biblioteca, it's important. It's important to continue this type of work.
One of the things that I often think about, too, though, when I'm working with indigenous communities across the continent, because this collection does cover the entire continent of what we call the Americas. So we're talking not only the native communities of what we call the United States, but also Mexico, Central America, South America, Hawaii, Philippines, Alaska, anything you can think of, Canada. It's a lot. But when I think about digitizing too, one of my concerns too are lack of resources within the community, right? So like, let's say like reservations and stuff like that don't have good like access to technology, technology, or even in Mexico, like where my friend's from, like they don't have good access to technology. How can we start working in a way where they have access to these archives too, if you don't have like Wi-Fi, if you don't have internet, right? So in my mind, scheming, I would love like for us to somehow, probably way down, I'm talking like somehow, or if someone with enough guilt gives us a donation.
White tears.
Enough white guilt gives us like some sort of huge fund where we can also make facsimiles of a lot of documents, where we can also give to the community copies of the stuff, right? So like for instance, my friend Victorino and I have been talking about ways in which we can make copies of like the codices that we have on Amate paper, the Popol Vuh, all the grammar books and the dictionaries in Nahuatl. How can we start printing those to have copies for his school that he's building so they can have a replica, in a way, of this collection of material that is about their community?
So with that note, again, visit the Newberry Library online. And before we go, I want you to give a shout out to your husband's band. Tell me the name of the band so people can listen. We can put a link in the website, and then also your website so people can learn more about what the amazing and wonderful work you do here in Chicago.
Yeah, so my husband's band is Panda Riot. So they're local from Chicago, started in Philly. So you can find their stuff if you just Google Panda Riot. Don't do Panda Bear. That's a different.
Wonderful, but not the same.
No. Much better Panda Riot. you can find them online. And then if you go to, if you're interested in some of the stuff I'm doing, you can just go to www.analulopez.com, and I post a lot of stuff on there. Be patient with my current website. I just decided to update it yesterday, so I'm still adding stuff, but most of my stuff content is on there. And if you ever want to visit the Newberry, just drop by and let me know and I can give you a tour.
And she's amazing. And read, people. Pónganse a leer, cabrón, no sean. Google it, loca. It's amazing. It's important to understand that, yes, there's different ways of understanding the world, but with the few tools that we have, with these fucking colonizers left us, there's still a lot of things that we can do. So let's all work together. Ana Lu, mil gracias. The second I met you, I'm like, she's going to be on my podcast. And there you are, only a month later. So thank you very much. And yes, thank you.
Yeah, and thank you, Tlazo Kamati.
Eso es lo que acaba de decir. And we are back. I told you guys. I told you that Ana Lu was amazing. And I know you heard in the background los perros y la chingada, but you know, I don't care. It was a great interview. And this is what happened. We had to improvise. She invited me and my husband for dinner. So we're like, fuck it, let's just do this. And it was amazing. I still collaborate with her. I'm going to continue to collaborate with her. And if you're in Chicago, I encourage you to go visit Ana Lu. So if you want more information, go to her website. Her Instagram is also on our page, but you can also reach out to me. And maybe if you're here in town, we can go together, because I look for excuses to go to talk to Ana Lu. But anyway, so I do have a recommendation before we go. I want to end the episode with a little bit of a light note. I've been listening to a lot of chill music. I've been listening to a lot of music that in a way allows me to work better. And right now, the music of wet bass has been coming back a lot, especially since it was around a week ago or so. Wet bass released a new double single. The double single is called Cosmovidencias 01 or Cosmovidencias 01. And this kid, I think he's like 24 years old. He's been releasing music for a couple years now. His name is Andres Jaime. He's from Mexico City. And in a way, it's part of this lo-fi bedroom pop, chill wave, psychedelic music that has been around, I'm going to say 15 years, but with the advent of YouTube, with the advent of the internet, and with the advent of all this equipment, music equipment with computers, you have kids making amazing music from their bedrooms and releasing it to the world through YouTube. And there's like a whole movement. I mean, one of the leading ones of this bedroom lo-fi pop, of course, is Cuco, which
By the way, he's also getting ready to release another, an actual full LP, so stay tuned for that, because I think it's going to be amazing. But Wet Bass has been doing stuff for a while, and he layers his influences, and it's wonderful to listen to everything from psychedelic rock of the 1970s to a throwback of, I don't know, Ariel Pink Haunted Graffiti from 10 years ago. So again, the name of the El Sencillo is called Cosmovidencia 01, and it has two songs, Solitario and Señal. They're wonderful songs that will help you relax, chill, and once again, hopefully will help you wash out all this nationalistic nonsense that is happening. No tea, no shade. If you're celebrating out there with your family, that's amazing. I wish I was with my family right now having burgers. But never, 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 never forget what's happening right now with our communities. Never forget what has been happening with our communities for 500 years. And keep those things in mind and pass that knowledge around, just like Ana Lu is doing in the library here in Chicago. So hopefully you enjoyed this. Hopefully you liked it. Remember that you can also be part of the conversation. You can send your questions to @AskWLPod. You can also visit us in all our social medias and Twitter and Instagram. And make sure to send us not only questions, but also tell us a little bit more about what you think about some of these episodes. We're getting ready to go on a 3-month break. But before that, we are hoping to get together again and do a proper goodbye just for now, because we're coming back and we have amazing things planned. So no se me agüiten and give us a break. A lot of things are happening, but good things are happening. And that's it. I hope you have a wonderful week. Ciao, 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 ciao.